I'm Josie Briggs. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. And I'm delighted to have with me today Vlado Perkovic, one of the leading clinical investigators in nephrology. Vlado is also Dean of Medicine at the University of New South Wales and has been one of our associate editors. As his dean duties have grown, he's told me he has to step down as an associate editor. So I wanted to have a parting conversation with you, Vlado, to capture some of your insights into clinical research in nephrology. And I wanted specifically to focus on a topic you and I have talked about on a number of occasions over the years, which is the need and challenges in implementing randomized clinical trials in nephrology. So first of all, kudos for the CANVAS trial and the incredibly rapidly evolving SGLT story. What a wonderful breakthrough for nephrology. A new insight of this magnitude was a long time in coming. What are some of the lessons we can draw from this evolving story?
Thanks, Josie, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today. It's a great honor for me, and I'm delighted to be here. The SGLT2 inhibitor story more broadly has been an incredibly transformative event for the community, and I think there are lots of lessons that we can learn. And I think it's worth us just going back and thinking about how these agents developed and where some of the critical points were. When these drugs were originally proposed and identified and developed, they were developed for glucose lowering because of their glycosuric effect. And in fact, there was great concern, of course, about using them in people with kidney disease because they lost their glycosuric effect as eGFR fell, and there was concern that they might have toxicities, be that acute kidney injury, metabolic disturbances, or a whole range of other potential problems. So as a nephrologist trying to understand these agents, to some degree, I and my colleagues were treated with a little bit of suspicion. Nonetheless, as the CANVAS trial, which I had the privilege of being on the steering committee for, got underway, and we saw the first interim data from that trial. It was a specific design which allowed the data from the first 4,000 people to be looked at by the regulatory agencies to approve the drug for glucose lowering in people with diabetes. And it meant that a whole array of data became available. And one of the things that we saw was a dramatic reduction in proteinuria in people who were macroalbuminuric, a 40-odd% reduction. And that was a surprise. It was a much bigger effect than we'd seen with any other glucose lowering drug, and it was, couldn't really be explained by the other effects of the drug that we knew. At the same time, colleagues were undertaking a whole range of laboratory research that had proposed tubular glomerular feedback as a potential pathway by which these drugs might actually have a renoprotective benefit. So, the ingredients that came together at that point were an unexpected observation on an intermediate outcome, which remains debated even today in proteinuria and the value of proteinuria. But it highlights how important it is that we have these sort of measures that can give us a signal of benefit relatively early so that we can then explore that with the very large investments required to prove benefit. The second thing was a plausible mechanism of effect, and we still don't know whether the tubular glomerular feedback is the whole story with SGLT2 inhibitors or whether there are other factors involved. But either way, it was really important in being able to articulate some mechanism by which these drugs might have a specific benefit to get the sort of investment from industry that we required to eventually run the CREDENCE trial. The third bit was patients. I started advocating for the CREDENCE trial in 2007, when I saw data from the ADVANCE trial, a glucose lowering trial of different intensities, suggesting a renal effect possibly in that study. And we started recruiting to the CREDENCE trial in 2014, 7 years later. So patience and commitment are really important to get important things done, I think. And then having a group of like-minded people who are prepared to commit to a long-term journey to explore this. And this included not just you know, some of my amazing colleagues who were working with me through this, people like Bruce Neal, Victor Zhu, Hido Lambis, Hiss, Bink, Adira Levin, many others. But also the industry partners who came along with us. And we had incredible commitment from Janssen, who were open, not only open to the idea, but really keen to identify potential benefits for the renal community. And pulling all of those people together, you know, we were able to really come together around this concept design and then launch the CREDENCE trial in 2013 and get it underway. And that common approach and that team-based approach, that deep integration, the frequent communication was critical, not just in designing the study, but in running it throughout. As we started to see the results of EMPA-REG and then CANVAS become available, we held our nerve with CREDENCE. We engaged our investigators and worked with the broader team in a very positive way, and were able to get very robust results at the end that offer hope now, I think, for people with diabetes. And based on the work of people like Hido Lambis, Hiss, Bink, and David Wheeler with DAPA-CKD, now to a much broader range of people with proteinuria kidney disease. So it's a very exciting time for us.
No, it's incredibly exciting. And the leadership and team building that it required has been something that all of us stand in awe of. And I do think the willingness of industry to invest in kidney disease is increased by this incredible success. And it's something that the whole discipline can build on. Do you agree?
Completely agree, Josie. I mean, back a decade ago, I spent a lot of time traveling from headquarters to headquarters of various potential industry partners, talking to them about potential renal trials. And there were many people who were incredibly enthusiastic, but one of the challenges was anxiety about the difficulty of doing trials in nephrology. And that's, you know, looking at it from a whole range of different perspectives, identifying the right population, identifying appropriate intermediate outcomes that we can use to identify whether there's a signal, not necessarily to prove that the drug works, but just to give us a sense of whether there's a signal there, and proteinuria serves that purpose well now. But, you know, it's difficult when there's a lot of debate about whether it's meaningful at all to convince people outside nephrology that it is useful. Then also looking at how do we convince them that there's a suitable market, that people will embrace these drugs if we show benefit, and getting data on just some of those simple things, counting up the number of people with kidney disease around the world. There's been a huge amount of work that's been done in that sort of area around the epidemiology that, again, is incredibly important when we're talking about asking industry partners potentially to commit hundreds of millions of dollars, and sometimes, you know, perhaps even more than $1 billion, to develop some of these agents and to run some of these sorts of trials to demonstrate efficacy. So I think we've come a long way with all of those various elements, and I think you're right, success breeds success, and it certainly breeds interest. And we're, I think, at the moment in a golden age of nephrology investment in clinical trials and partnerships in nephrology in clinical trials around the world. We're seeing, you know, amazing numbers of investigator-initiated trials of incredibly high quality, of industry partnerships, you know, an array of different potential benefits in kidney conditions where certainly some of which I've been told over the years it's just impossible to do properly powered trials, and you know, that's been shown to be false. We've shown that we can do it, so I'm really excited about what the future holds in our partnerships with industry.
So as you know, I spent a good part of my career as a public sector funder, and the public sector is more likely to invest in studies that take on questions like how we practice medicine. It's hard in this area not to have a little bit of cardiology envy. It feels to me like the cardiologists have been ahead of us in taking on questions like the timing of interventions, And in nephrology, there are lots of timing and who to dialyze when and how to manage potassium or bicarbonate, simple interventions. What are your thoughts about these practical questions, and are they being asked, and how can we build willingness to take on these often long and still expensive but very practical questions about the practice in nephrology?
Yeah, Josie, I think this is frankly the responsibility of all of us in the nephrology community to make these happen. I mean, if we're not prepared to invest in showing whether these sorts of interventions work, frankly, we shouldn't be imposing them on our patients. And, you know, the classic example there is phosphate lowering, where we ask our people with advanced kidney disease to take vast numbers of phosphate binders each day, and yet there is no robust evidence to show that that produces any meaningful benefit at the moment for our patients. Those trials are now underway. There's a couple of different studies that are looking at that question, and they're fabulous. They're international, collaborative, funded by government agencies primarily. They are engaging entire bodies of clinicians in the design and conduct of the study, and hopefully they'll answer those sorts of fundamental questions in a reliable way. And we're seeing that also in people receiving dialysis, with things like dialysis temperature, potassium, sodium, a whole range of fundamental elements of how we dialyze people that have never really been properly assessed but are now being assessed. And I think that's exciting. I'd like to see us take all of that to the next level. I think we need to build these collaborative groups around the world, because there's so many advantages to doing this in an internationalized way, not just in terms of the sort of populations that we might need to robustly answer the questions and giving us bigger sample sizes, but also by pulling together people from different parts of the world and with different health systems to maximize generalizability and to understand whether the results are consistent in different sort of contexts. So I think those sorts of collaborative groups moving forward are the future, and I'd love to see them grow and develop even more. And I'd love, frankly, to see some public sector investment in building those sorts of collaboratives, these sort of clinical trial laboratories that could provide an infrastructure that can test multiple different interventions at the same time and evolve and learn in an ongoing way, so that we do build the evidence base that we need to understand whether we are managing our patients properly. One of my intensive care colleagues here in Australia did a study several years ago where they wandered around an intensive care unit and they documented all the decisions that were made about different things that were done to a number of patients in the intensive care unit over a period of days. And they looked at what proportion of those decisions were evidence-based. And it turned out that 5% of the decisions that were made were based on clinical trial data, whereas 95% were things that seemed like a good idea. I don't know what those numbers are for nephrology. I suspect they're not that much different, but I'd love to see that change. And I think, again, it's our responsibility as clinicians to improve the quality of our practice by building the evidence base that drives it.
I totally agree. Capturing the decisional issues and the decisional dilemmas is also key in willingness to randomize or an investment of practitioners in getting trials done. Another topic that's coming up a lot in the COVID era is the need to simplify trial design. The several large platform trials have been done for treatment of COVID, but what do you think nephrology needs to do to be able to simplify and perhaps create greater external generalizability in trials?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot that we can do here, Josie, and I think this has been, you know, one of the big tragedies of the last 50 years, where an industry is built up that has complicated clinical trials and has built in a whole range of different elements under the cover of improving so-called quality to that have made clinical trial conduct incredibly complicated and incredibly expensive. It's critical that we run high quality trials and that we pay attention to those areas where there might be problems, whether that's related to sloppiness or fraud or or bias. We need to think through the risks for each of our trials and build processes to check it. But when we get to the stage, as we did some years ago, where people were obsessing over the colour of the pens that were used to fill out forms, we've gone to a ridiculous extent. And there's a lot of people blaming each other. Clinicians blame and investigators blame the drug companies. Industry blames the regulators. Regulators, in turn, blame others. And no one's really taken responsibility for this problem or ownership of it, perhaps to the extent that we'd like to. There are certainly groups that have tried to do this, some of the initiatives out of Oxford and Duke and other places that have really advocated for the simplification of clinical trials with some success. But I'm really hopeful that incredibly powerful and impactful initiatives such as the COVID-related platform trials that we've seen in the UK through the recovery group, will lead to some change. It's an incremental thing. We're moving the boundaries slowly, and I'd love to see that accelerated, because we still do so many things that are not important, and that means that we often don't do some of the things that really would be important. And I'd love to see that balance shift. But it's something that we need to be committed to in the renal community. There are people in other parts of medicine doing this. We need to be at the center of those efforts.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very thoughtful, very important response. Well, we also have talked in papers we've seen in Jason with regularity about issues around the treatment of glomerular nephritides. This feels like an area where too often the decisions are made based on practitioner practice preference with really remarkably little evidence, probably just like that ICU survey you mentioned. So where are we in seeing progress in the management of glomerular nephritis?
Yeah, Josie, I'm really excited about what's happening in glomerular nephritis at the moment. I think we're just at that transition point, and I think the next decade may well be the golden age of glomerular nephritis trials, in the same sort of way as we've seen with diabetes over the last decade. When I've been jointly leading a trial called the Testing Study looking at steroids in IgA nephropathy since 2011, with Hong Zhang from Peking University in China and others, a large group of leading experts around the world. And when we ran that, when we designed that study, the largest trial in glomerular nephritis, or in IgA nephropathy specifically, which is where that trial was based, was about 100 people. And when we talked about doing a trial that was several fold bigger, many people told me it couldn't be done and it was a waste of resources. We collectively ignored that, and we designed the study, and we've now randomized 503 patients, and the results we're hoping to report the American Society of Nephrology meeting this year with effects of steroids on heart outcomes. And boy, have we learned a lot of things along the way. We've learned about the toxicity of high-dose steroids, which was unexpected in terms of the extent that we saw it. We saw 20 people have serious adverse effects in the first 130 people treated with steroids, such that we had to change the treatment algorithm and create effectively a second wave study. And that included two people in their 20s who died from steroid-related infections. It was terrible for us being involved in that study and unexpected in terms of the magnitude. But it just highlights that if we don't do these sorts of studies, none of us are going to see treat a couple of hundred people with steroids in a short period of time. So we're never going to get the experience of the sort of adverse events that we might see. And it's why we need to do these properly powered studies. And I'm so excited now in the field of IgA nephropathy in particular, to see some of the work that's being done. There's large studies now, several hundred patients of oral budesonide that have generated and reported, or at least described, very promising results. This week, we had another trial that I'm involved in of sparsentan, that the PROTECT study, which where a press release was put out highlighting a profound reduction in albuminuria, in proteinuria, in people treated with sparsentan compared to people treated with irbesartan. We're now seeing complement inhibition explored. We're seeing a range of other potential therapies exploring both immunomodulatory treatments, but also other types of therapies for this condition. And just to give you a sense of how important it is, in the testing study, which we began back in 2011, so we've now got some patients who've been in that trial for a decade. In the original 260 patients, we reported the results, the interim results in JAMA, when we had the excess of serious infections. And amongst those 260 patients, out now to an average of probably about 6 years, we've seen well over 100 of those end up on dialysis. So this is, a profoundly progressive long-term condition. And that's the other thing. I think, we need to think about duration of follow-up in these studies, because we treat them as we'd sometimes study them as if all the problems occur over a few years, but of course they're accumulative over many years. So in IgA nephropathy, just as one example, we've now got real excitement. We've got a regulatory pathway that has encouraged investment by offering the opportunity of using proteinuria reduction to get provisional approval, much as many other fields of medicine do. While proper outcome studies are done and industry has stepped up to the plate and really invested in IgA nephropathy. And we're starting to see some of those sorts of investments now wash into conditions like focal glomerulosclerosis, membranous glomerulonephritis, and others. So I'm really excited about the insights we might learn about these important kidney-specific conditions. They're our conditions. It's not like diabetic kidney disease where we have to argue with the diabetologists about whose problem this is. This is our problem. And we need to solve it. And I think over the next decade, we're going to transform the experience for our patients with glomerulonephritis. And I find that incredibly exciting.
Yeah, it is. Every nephrologist struggles with these patients, and every honest nephrologist knows they don't have clear-cut answers. And the steroid experience that you published was really an eye-opener. All of us had seen an occasional issue like this, but the frequency actually was much higher than we expected. So just one last topic I do want us to address, and that is the problems of, once we have a new insight, the translation of that into actual practice. People are beginning to talk about implementation science as a new field, but how do we think about this in nephrology, and what can we collectively do to ensure that insights that emerge from this work really moves as rapidly as possible to our patients?
Yeah, I think this is sort of the next frontier for us, perhaps in many aspects of nephrology now, Josie. We've still got studies being published today, 20 years after the identification of the benefits of renin-angiotensin system blockade in diabetic kidney disease, that suggest that at least in some health systems, the use of these agents in appropriate patients may be as low as 20 or 25%. It's terrible data if we believe that this is true and representative, and it's an indictment on us as a profession. It's also dramatically underestimating the problem, because it's only looking at those people who present to hospital with a condition or who are involved in a health service, and there are probably many others who may not be attending health services or perhaps may not even have their disease diagnosed. So I think this is an area that we really need to build capacity in. We don't have capacity in this area in nephrology to the extent that they do, for example, in cancer or perhaps even cardiovascular disease. And I used to joke with my cardiology friends that there was no point us spending time on implementation science because we don't have enough evidence-based therapies to implement. But I don't think that's true anymore. And I think we now need to really focus on this area. And we've got the opportunity to learn from other fields of medicine where they've been really driving this forward for decades. And if we want our patients to benefit from the scientific insights that have been developed, you know, we can't just assume it's going to happen. We have to go out there actively to make it happen. And that means looking at entirely different approaches. So if we use the example of diabetic kidney disease, people say, well, how do we get the right drug prescribed? But that's only a tiny fraction of the problem. If you think about all the steps that need to be undertaken for someone, for example, with diabetic kidney disease to end up on an SGLT2 inhibitor, firstly, they have to attend a health service, which doesn't happen for large proportions of the population. They have to be tested for diabetes. They have to have a urine albumin creatinine ratio and a serum creatinine measured. Again, even in some diabetes practices, these things are not routine. They then have to see a practitioner who's aware of the data and who knows how to use the drugs. They have to be prescribed the right treatment. They have to actually fill those scripts, again, which is another barrier, particularly when cost comes into the equation, as it has here. And then they have to keep taking those agents over a period of time. And at every one of those steps, we see a proportion of people falling over. So if we just leave it to chance effectively, the number of people who get through all of those barriers will be a tiny proportion of those who might benefit. And the challenge for us now is to look at scientific approaches to assessing different strategies to address those challenges so that we get these evidence-based treatments to the people that need them. And, you know, this needs to be a focus for us as a nephrology community, and I hope for the journal, Josie, over coming years to really translate some of these identified benefits into real better outcomes for our patients.
Yeah, and of course, the burdens of kidney disease fall much more heavily on underserved populations across the board, minority populations particularly. And our healthcare system systems are really not serving these patients whose needs are in fact often greater. So this need to bring a broader range of people to the table, including healthcare providers and public health, and breaking down the barriers between public health and practice of medicine is essential if we're going to make some progress at these incredible inequities. I don't know the data for Australia, but I do know the data for U.S. and the difference in life expectancy for Black men in America is about a decade compared to age-matched whites. And this is, these are shocking facts, and they really aren't changing. So hopefully a combination of determined practitioners and good science and policies can help make a difference here. I do view this as part of the mission of the journal, is to make sure our readers are regularly reminded of these issues and shown data that reminds all of us of our shared responsibilities to make a healthcare system that does a better job.
It's so important in every country around the world. I don't think this is at all US specific, but the specific nature of the issues might be different, but the principle is the same. I think everywhere, it's certainly true here in Australia where I live, and it's been highlighted by some of the COVID outbreaks. For example, we're here in Sydney at the moment with COVID outbreak centred on some of our non-English speaking communities, people who perhaps don't have the same level of trust for institutions, don't understand some of the messaging because it's not provided in a way that addresses their needs and that really understands their background. And we've seen this in countries around the world now where there's a need to tailor our approach to get the outcomes that we want to those needs of the specific communities, and to be thoughtful and proactive about it. And I think that's an important lesson for us, and it's wonderful to see the lead the journal's taken in addressing some of these sorts of questions under your leadership, Josie, and long may it continue.
Well, thank you, Vlado. It really is a matter of learning how to build trust. And sometimes that does require that we bring people who truly understand these communities into the to our tables and talk together about how to solve these problems. And certainly kidney disease acts as a kind of canary to show the inequities of the healthcare system. Well, thank you, Vlado, for a wonderful conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I've loved the insights I've learned from you over the years. You've been part of the journal, and we'll still turn to you for advice on some of the hard decisions we will face going forward. But again, really, my most sincere thanks. And again, congratulations on your extraordinary leadership in the evolving SGLT story, and I'm sure in the glomerulonephritis story as well. I look forward to hearing those talks at the ASN meeting, whether it's virtual or in person. I'm sure we're going to be learning new things from the studies you're leading. So we'll end at that point, but we will stay in touch.
Many thanks, Jesse. Look forward to continuing to work with you.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare provider if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.